You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Journalist and documentary filmmaker Mazia Bakhari was reporting on the 2009 presidential elections in Iran for Newsweek when he was arrested in his mother's home one morning. He was held in Evin prison and brutally interrogated for 116 days and was released and able to return to his home in London just days before his wife gave birth to their daughter. He describes his experiences and looks at the state of contemporary Iran in Then They Came to Me, a family story of love, captivity, and survival. It's written with the help of Amy Malloy, and it's published by Random House. I'm very pleased that it brings Mazia Bakhari to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here.
So what were the circumstances of your arrest? You'd been in Iran covering the presidential election. Were you worried at the time that you were being watched and were at risk of being detained?
At that time, I did not know that I was being watched, but a journalist working in Iran is always at the risk of being detained.
An Iranian journalist, especially one who is an emigre, would probably even be more vulnerable?
Especially someone who is not always writes or makes films which are favorable to the government. So I always knew that I was somehow at risk, but that's a risk that people live in Iran on a day-to-day basis. But later on, I found out that I was being watched for a period of time before my arrest.
Now, your title is obviously a reference to a famous poem by Pastor Martin Niemöller, referring to what happened in Germany during the Nazi period. Do you see any similarities in your experiences or your perceptions?
I see similarities between all dictatorships. I see similarities between all people who are fighting for freedom of expression. I can just say that whether you are in Stalin's Russia, whether you are in some Western-supported dictatorships, whether you are in...
You almost said democracy.
Yeah, Western dictatorships, or, you know, Western-supported dictatorships, or, you know, in ideological dictatorships like Iran, you see different similarities because the weak point for these governments, for these dictatorships, is information. They know that they have to control the information in order to control people.
Well, there were these massive protests following the election. I wonder, were you just reporting on them in the way that we'd expect a Western reporter to have done it? Or would the Iranians have felt that maybe was slanting the news?
Well, Iranians, Iranian government at that time, they thought that the media was part of the opposition, because the opposition was receiving information about the wrongdoings of the Iranian government, about the vote riggings, possible vote riggings at that time. And also they were talking about the concern of the outside world about what's happening in Iran. So Iranian government thought that the media was part of the opposition. And as I said, they wanted to control the information. Basically, what I can say about the Iranian government, which is it's a 20th century dictatorship. It is a dictatorship that's prepared to block shortwave radio, newspapers, or terrestrial television. It is not prepared to deal with the internet, with satellite television. And because of that inability to deal with modern technology and modern media, they were just very insecure about their own survival. And as a result, they started a crackdown as soon as people came to the streets and protested against the election.
Did the man who picked you up tell you why you were being arrested? Does Iranian law require them to make formal charges?
Iranian law requires everyone to show the arrest warrant, to say that which organization they're from and what are the charges. And sometimes they have to send the arrest warrant in advance. And sometimes, in my cases, in the media case. But the man who came to arrest me that morning, he had an arrest warrant for me, which was like a fading photocopy of, I guess, 100 other arrest copies that they've had. And he put his hand on where the signature was, so I didn't know which organization he was from. I didn't know the charges. And as soon as I said something, he said that, sit down, shut up, otherwise I know how to deal with you.
Were you speaking to him in Farsi?
In Persian, yes. Yeah.
So where did they take you?
They didn't tell me where they were taking me. They didn't tell my family where they were taking me. So I was not supposed to know where they were taking me. But from the direction of the car, even though I was blindfolded, as soon as I saw we were heading north on a highway, I knew that they were taking me to Evin prison, which is in North Tehran.
And this is one of the more notorious prisons?
This is the most notorious prison in Iran. It's a prison that was built in the Shah's time in 1969. It was finished, I think, in 1970. And in the Shah's time, it was synonymous with torture and executions. But the situation became worse after the revolution because many of the people who were tortured in the Shah's time came to power. And they knew how to torture better. And they started even a more intensified repression.
Now, your father had been arrested during the Shah's time. Had he been taken to Evin prison?
No, my father was arrested and was imprisoned in the 1950s. Evin was not built at that time. He was in other prisons. But he went through similar experiences that went on in Evin before the revolution and after the revolution.
Now, you mentioned that you were blindfolded in the trip to the prison. You were blindfolded a lot of this time, weren't you?
Basically, as soon as I came out of my solitary confinement, I was blindfolded. The only time I could take the blindfold off was when I was on my own in the solitary confinement, surrounded by walls.
You referred to the man who arrested and interrogated you as Mr. Rosewater because all you really knew about him was how he smelled.
Exactly.
What did the fact that he smelled like rosewater reveal to you about him?
Well, I had very little information about him, so I had somehow decoded his personality through the details that I could see from under my blindfold or through smell.
Like his shoes.
Like his shoes or like his slippers. You know, I remember that the first time when I saw him in his slippers, I got really worried. Because when you're in your shoes, it means that you may want you're working and then you're going away or can come back because you're prepared to go out. But in Iran, when people put their slippers on, it means that they're going to be in that space for a long time. And when I saw his shining black slippers, I knew that he was going to be there for a long time. And then I had to decode the shining black slippers because if it was a low-ranking functionary, he would not have a leather slipper. He would have just a plastic sandal.
And he might have holes in his socks.
He might have holes. But his socks were impeccable and his slippers were impeccable. And so that really got me worried that I have to deal with this guy for a long time.
Do you have any sense of whether he was a member of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps?
He was towards the end. I mean, I guessed it from the beginning, but towards the end of my incarceration, they told me that they were members.
And what does that mean? What does that mean in the case of somebody who's arrested? Are they a major force in the government?
They are a brutal force in the government, and they are the major force of the government. But the main thing is that they are a brutal force in the government. And I was arrested by the Revolutionary Guards Intelligence Unit, which is composed of the people who are dismissed from fired from the Ministry of Intelligence, meaning that they are not even experts in their area. So whereas sometimes when you're arrested by Ministry of Intelligence, you know that they know your charges, or even if they put you under interrogation, they are using Western methods or more scientific methods of interrogation. The Revolutionary Guards, because it's a new force and they don't get along actually well with the Ministry of Intelligence, they just use brute force from the beginning. So my interrogator, he just had fabricated charges against me. And he was beating me to a pulp in order for me to admit to those charges.
My guest is Maziar Bahari. His book, Then They Came for Me, A Family Story of Love, Captivity, and Survival. It is published by Random House. So they were trying to find out things? Was this a fishing expedition?
No, they were not trying to find out anything. They had a series of charges against me, and they were trying to pressure me as much as possible in order I break down and admit to those charges.
Did you know before this experience how to deal with interrogation like this, how to answer their questions without saying something that might incriminate you?
Somehow, because, as you said, my father was in prison in the 1950s for 4 years.
And then my sister.
And then my sister was in prison during Khomeini's time for 6 years. And I had a lot of conversations with my father and my sister about this. And one of the main things that my father always told me was that someone who's in prison should never name names. Because when you mention one name, they ask you for another name, and then another. And then they can incriminate you through naming names. So whenever they forced me to confess, I just stuck to the generalities. I talked about the fact that the Western media is bad and it's evil, and you know that the Western media is run by the Jews and Zionists. But I never named names. Because I knew that would, and I knew that, you know, even whatever I said about general ideas, no one really cared about that.
But the reason you were saying those things is because you thought that that might ingratiate you to them?
Because I just
thought that might be enough?
I just thought that they would release the pressure. Because they were forcing me to make those confessions.
Well, one of the things they used as evidence against you was a video of you on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Yes, because they had fabricated charges against me, and they were such outlandish charges. They were telling me that I was the master of Western media in Iran. They were charging me up espionage. They were telling me that we have films of you spying. So they had to come up with different evidence. And because their charges were fabricated, they had to come up with the fabricated evidence, including an interview with Jason Jones, who came to the quote-unquote correspondent for The Daily Show, who came to Iran and pretended to be a spy. And he called me Agent Pistachio. So because they didn't have any real evidence, they were fabricating evidence against me. And not only that.
But they didn't realize that that was a joke?
I'm sure they knew it. It was not real evidence. But to them, if somebody is pretending to be a spy, who's looking like a spy, who talks like a spy, and who says he's a spy, he must be a spy. And so let's incriminate him. But they were just trying to tell me that, we can't use any evidence we want against you. You have no escape from here, and you have no help. So just admit to what we are asking you to admit.
So they looked at your Facebook page, try to use your connections and pictures against you, and at one point he accused you of having spent time in New Jersey. Now, why was he concerned about New Jersey?
Well, you know, New Jersey to him was like paradise. New Jersey to him was some place that was not reachable in his lifetime, like paradise. He thought that New Jersey is where people drink all the time, they can copulate all the time, and whatever he wanted to do, he really wanted to do. And he hated me because of that. But in fairness to him, I have to say that there is a reason for him, and I found out about that later, that why he was so fascinated with New Jersey. That's because the Iranian diplomats who work for the Iranian mission in the UN in New York, they cannot travel outside of a 25-mile radius from their office on 3rd Avenue. So most of them, or all of them, they have houses in New Jersey. So when they go back home, their American experience is summarized in their experience in New Jersey. So they talk about New Jersey this, New Jersey that. It's beautiful in New Jersey. The hospitals are good in New Jersey. The schools are good. So this guy, I'm sure he had a conversation with a cousin or a relative who was in New Jersey, and he thought that, oh, my God, New Jersey is just like paradise. And I hate this guy.
Yeah. I wonder what's going to happen now with all the cutbacks in New Jersey. But
I'm not going to tell him about that.
Mr. Rosewater brought up sex a lot. Why do you think he was so interested in your sex life? And was that connected to New Jersey?
Part of his connection with his fascination with New Jersey, I'm sure it had to do with sex. I'm not sure if he was a big fan of Jersey Shore and he had a crush on Snooki from Jersey Shore or not. I'm not sure about that. But to these guys who are really ideological and indoctrinated, sex is a big thing. And they think about sex a lot. I was listening to an interview with John Waters, and he said that people go to really ridiculous lengths in order to have sex. But it works the other way around as well. People go to really ridiculous lengths not to have sex. And they have to really suppress their hormones. They really have to suppress their desires. And for him, having sex on Earth was sinful. He had to wait to go to paradise or New Jersey in order to have sex. For him, me being in Iran or in the West, even the possibility of having that, it was unbelievable and sinful. And, you know, in the beginning, I didn't know what to do with him. I always said that, no, sir, I never did that. And then I thought that, well, if that is really his weak spot, I should just use it to my own advantage. So eventually, I started to torture him through my really lurid sexual stories. And, you know, I just used my imagination. I just used all my knowledge of Western literature, Lady Chatterley's Lover, Madame Bovary, and, you know, Arthur Schnitzler's
La Ronde.
La Ronde. And, you know, I just came up with all these ideas, and I could just see him that, you know, he was sitting in a dark room. I could just see him breathing. And the good thing about it was that he was not beating me at the time. And that was just a relief for me.
You're upsetting me as well. Mazia Bahari is an award-winning journalist, documentary filmmaker, and human rights activist, and a correspondent for Newsweek from 1998 to 2010. That's what when he was arrested in Iran. He's written a book called Then They Came For Me, A Family Story of Love, Captivity, and Survival. It's published by Random House. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Mazia Bahari, his book, Then They Came For Me, A Family Story of Love, Captivity, and Survival, published by Random House. At one point, you were brought to the office of a man named Haj Agha. Who's he?
Haj Agha is a title that's given to people who do the pilgrimage. Haj, meaning that someone who's been to the Hajj, to pilgrimage. And in terms of Iranian security apparatus, it means that someone who is senior in the Revolutionary Guards. And they took me blindfolded one night to his office. I could smell, because I was blindfolded again, I could smell that there were lots of men in the room. And they sat me down, this Haj Agha, who sounded like a television personality who talks about evil Western media. He told me that, we know, Mr. Bahari, that you're a spy, and we in espionage cases, unlike other judicial cases, you are guilty until proven innocent. And he told me as nonchalantly as I'm telling you that in espionage cases, it may take between 6 to 7 years to investigate the case. And at the end of 6 or 7 years, we may exonerate you and say sorry and you can go, or we can execute you. And he was saying all these words calmly. And I just thought about my family, and I just thought about my loved ones. And, you know, my mouth was dry. I didn't know what to do. And then he said, but we can also make a deal. And then I asked him, what kind of a deal? He said, well, you can make a televised confession against Western media, and then that can lead to your release. So the next day, I was interviewed by three different broadcasters, Iranian television, Revolutionary Guards News Agency, and Iranian government's English satellite channel, Press TV. And Then the next day, Hajaga told me that in order to make the conversation more natural, we're going to give you a haircut and we'll allow you to shave. And then we're going to divide the scenario about the Western, evil Western media into questions and answers. So we are going to give the questions to quote-unquote reporters, and then you can answer those questions. So I sat in front of three cameras, and I had to talk about Western media and their role in provoking Iranian people against the Holy Islamic Republic. And
you did what they wanted.
I did part of what they wanted me to do, because they also wanted me to name certain individuals, certain reformists who are members of the Islamic Republic's establishment who've turned against it. And they wanted me to admit that I put them in touch with the Western governments. But I just stuck to the generalities. I didn't name names.
Were these televised confessions common in Iran at the time?
It's been common in Iran since 1970, let's say. Even in the Shah's time, they had some televised confession. But then the Islamic Republic turned it into a macabre art form. And they at least there are four or five televised confessions every year. People admitting to different things. And when you hear about the circumstances of these confessions and how the people were coerced into making this confession, it is really, really gruesome.
But that they didn't release you. In fact, Mr. Rosewater began beating you along with interrogating you.
Yes.
So they made a deal and then they reneged on the deal?
They reneged on the deal, and they told me that part of our deal was to name names, but then you just started to talk about general ideas, and that's not going to help us. You have to name certain individuals. You have to tell us that you put certain people in touch with the Western governments. And he was always telling me that you can either tell us, or maybe tomorrow morning we wake you up at 5 o'clock in the morning, we can put you on a chair, put a noose around your neck, and then I personally just kicked the chair off your feet. And he was always threatening me with execution. But he said, if you name a name, I personally guarantee that you're going to be released tomorrow. And I knew that he was lying. I knew that the system was lying. And because of that, I never named names. And finally, after 2 or 3 months, they just gave up.
But other journalists have died while in custody. And despite international pressure, there was international pressure in your case. Were you aware of it? Were you aware that Hillary Clinton was talking about you?
I was in solitary confinement for 107 days, and my only contact with the outside world was my interrogator and the prison guards who brought me food and, you know, took me to the bathroom.
So your wife was pregnant at the time. You had no idea what was going on.
I had no idea. I mean, I talked to my mother a couple of times. I saw my mother twice. But when I saw my mother, there was a soldier present in our meeting. So we couldn't talk about anything else except family stuff, health of the family. But one day, I think it was the 90th day or something of my arrest, one of the prison guards called me Mr. Hillary Clinton. And because I was alone in my solitary confinement, I didn't have anything to do. I was doing a lot of exercise. I was doing push-ups. I was doing a lot of push-ups. I was doing a lot of sit-ups. And I was doing a sit-up, and this prison guard said, Mr. Hillary Clinton, you have to, you know, go to the bathroom. I was like, why? Why Mr. Hillary Clinton? And he said, you know, that she's been talking about you a lot. And there and then, I knew that there is an international campaign for me, that, you know, that if the Secretary of State of the United States cared for me, it means that there is a campaign.
But I'm assuming that during the darkest times, you were afraid that you'd been forgotten.
I thought that I was forgotten. I mean, in my, because you see, solitary confinement is the worst kind of torture. So you're hallucinating when you're in solitary confinement. You somehow even develop a schizophrenic character. Sometimes you're very happy, sometimes you're very sad. at times, I was just laughing at my interrogator's ridiculous comments. But other times, you know, there was time that I wanted to commit suicide. So in my, and I have migraine, and he knew that I had migraine. So he was punching me in the head in order to have more impact. And people who have migraine can testify that when you have migraine, when your pain is so intense, you feel really low about everything in your life, and you just want to finish life sometimes. And in those moments, I thought, what if no one cares about me? And that was really, really sad.
Could push you toward suicide.
I thought about it once, actually. And then that was beautiful because my father's voice came to me and said, don't do their job for them. If they want to execute you, they're going to execute you. Don't be their agent. Don't work with them.
Were there conditions attached to your release?
Yes, yes. What happened towards the end of my arrest was that the Revolutionary Guards knew that they could not force me to name names. And because of the international pressure, they had to release me. And you have to remember that in September 2009, Iran was starting in nuclear negotiations with the United States present for the first time in Geneva. So they wanted to have this nuclear negotiations with as little interruption as possible. So they just thought that they should release me, and they didn't want, you know, because my wife was not in very good health, they didn't want to have, as they said later, that they didn't want to have a dead mother and dead baby on their hands. So they wanted to release me. But in order to save face, we went through a scenario that I had to spy for them. And I said, yes, of course, if you release me, if you let me go to London, I can go to a friend's house who is a member of the opposition. I put eavesdropping devices. And I use all my knowledge of John le Carré novels and spy novels in order to make scenarios. Same thing with those sexual scenarios. And I came up with like the weirdest devices. Yes, I can just go to Henry Kissinger's office and I can just put something in his trash can. And then, you know, you can hear all Kissinger's. And I don't know if they believed me or not, but it was a face-saving measure for them.
Well, they knew you were a reporter for Newsweek. And so maybe you would have access to Henry Kissinger.
Probably, yeah.
Was your father a supporter? Your father had passed away by this
time. My father passed away.
And your sister as well. Yes. But had your father been a supporter of the revolution that overturned the Shah?
In the beginning, yes, because my father was in prison and tortured by the Shah, so he always remained.
But your sister was imprisoned by the Revolutionary Guard.
Of course, yes.
What had she done?
And she was a revolutionary as well. She was also a member of the Communist Party of Iran after the revolution. And she was supportive of Ayatollah Khomeini. And unfortunately, like many other revolutionaries, they were also supportive of their suppression of other groups. So in the beginning of the revolution, I can never forget that when they were killing the members of the Shah's regime without fair trial. Many people in my family, including my father and my sister, they were not unhappy. I can say that they were even happy that they were killing these people. And it was a really shameful episode in Iranian history.
When did you leave? And you went to Canada first.
I left Iran in 1986. I moved to Pakistan because I had to leave Iran illegally. I didn't have a passport. Then I went to Canada, and then I moved to the UK.
And when you came back?
It was in 1997. When the reformist president Khatami was elected. And it was a very euphoric atmosphere at the time because I left at the height of Khomeini's dictatorship. And when I came back and I saw many people were rethinking their ideas, basically Iran in the late 90s was going through a revolution of second thoughts. And it was a very exciting time to be there.
Well, you had been arrested when you were a teenager for having long hair.
I was.
Could you have long hair during the Khatami period? Did things change again when Ahmadinejad came to power?
No, actually, in terms of what Ahmadinejad and his cohorts said that they wanted to do, they said that we want to follow a Chinese model. that people can have social freedom, young men and women, they can, you know, mingle freely and they can be together and people can listen to Western music, but they didn't want to give people political freedom like China. So in terms of social freedom, not much change after Ahmadinejad. And Ahmadinejad, these days, Ahmadinejad, of course, as you know, he's in a fierce infighting against Khamenei, especially since January this year. Yeah.
It's amazing that he survived, because he's not just in this power struggle with Khamenei, who is the supreme leader, but also with various leaders in the parliament. So what does that mean, do you think?
Well, basically, Ahmadinejad and his people rightly have realized that the situation is untenable in Iran, that after the demise of Mubarak in Egypt, Ben Ali in Tunisia, and Saleh in Yemen now, they know that they have to distance themselves from Khamenei, who is the real dictator in Iran. So they've started to talk about Iranian nationalism. And not directly, but indirectly, they are questioning the foundations of Shia clergy that puts Khamenei in power and gives legitimacy to Khamenei. But
there's also clergy who are opposed to the way the country is being run.
They are, yes. But the thing is that in Iran, people have long historical memory. If Ahmadinejad and his group, they were intellectuals, if they were genuine in their ideas, people would accept it.
A listener, Patrick, asks, has your story received any attention from the press in Iran?
Oh, yes. I was telling you about the forced confession that I had to make. After I came out, that Press TV, which is the Iranian English channel, showed my coerced confession, and I launched a complaint against it at Ofcom, which is the British broadcasting regulator. And after 18 months, all my complaints were upheld 2 weeks ago. So since then, the Iranian regime has started a negative campaign against me. First, they called me an MI6 agent, and then recently...
That's because you live in England now.
Yes, and then they called me that I'm a Zionist, and not only Zionist, that I'm acting on the 7th protocol of the protocols of elders of Zion. They're very specific in their anti-Semitism, by the way. Yeah.
So I assume you can't go back.
That's a safe assumption, yes.
At least until there's regime change.
I have a 13.5-year sentence in absentia, so if I go back, I have to at least endure that.
What about your mother? Are you worried about her safety?
My mother is in Iran. She is a patriotic Iranian. She doesn't want to leave the country. She says that I was born in this country, I live in this country, and I will die in this country. She comes and visits us in London, but... you never know. But the worst thing that can happen to her is for me to be silent and not talk about my experience.
Mazia Bahari has written with the help of Amy Malloy, Then They Came For Me, A Family Story of Love, Captivity, and Survival. It's published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
Very nice to be here.